Well, when did you start to work on Teflon?
Well, most of the projects, of course, that we were working on during the period were identified with the war effort. Practically everything we were doing was...
Was that true even back in 38 and 39, or did that develop only after 41?
We began to become defense-oriented before 41, I don't know what I'd been working on tooth reconstruction materials, early dental filling materials with led to the acrylic denture materials, and so some of it had peacetime application, but we began to get more and more defense oriented. At the time we began working on Teflon, of course there'd been the announcement of what Plunkett had found, and although Plunkett in this, when he opened the cylinder and found the valve plugged, he never followed through on anything. I think the original patent suggested silver nitrate as a catalyst and a few things just to get the patent in, because it was recognized that this would be an important thing. And then Butch Hanford and his group, Bob Joyce and a fellow named Sauer and Ken Berry and a number of them had been working on the polymerization process at the experimental station. And it was recognized that although the Jackson Laboratory, where the thing had been discovered, would do monomer synthesis, the organic chemicals, the plastics department would take up the polymerization and development. And so the thing came to us, and we were kind of working along on the same lines that they were doing at the experimental station, when which leads into the story that I had told you about. My then boss, P. Willard Crane, came to me one day and he said, "We've been invited to go over and talk to Professor Dunning at Columbia." And Willard always was one to play his cards close to his chest, so I don't know how much he knew in advance of what we were going to hear, but I was quite pop-eyed by the conversations we had with Dunning. J.R. Dunning was an enthusiastic, able physicist who got right to the point when we went in to see him, and he told us that there was a development now coming on in this country and in Germany which would determine who would win the war, and that it was going to be extraordinarily important for us to be participating at our maximum strength. And so that he knew that we were making polytetrafluoroethylene at Arlington, and that this was going to be vital to the war effort. There was going to be urgent demand for us, and he had a schedule for us to meet, and that we were to have 1 week to complete our development work on the polymerization process. We would have 2 weeks for the design of a plant. We would have 1 week for its construction, and then we were supposed to be producing polytetrafluoroethylene at the rate, I think, of 1 million pounds a month. Now, it may have been 1 million pounds a year, but I think it was 1 million pounds a month. And so we never made that schedule, but it did turn out...
What was Crane's response?
Well, we both felt this was a little unrealistic, and I never really knew whether DuPont management knew about this in advance or whether this was the first contact. Mm-hmm. Willard, of course, went back and went up the line to tell them what our conversation had been, but the thing that we tried to speculate on what this could be, and we really didn't think of nuclear energy as being involved, but several weeks later I took some of our samples of polytetrafluoroethylene over to Columbia, and by that time it was known as the SAM Laboratories, and it was... You had a sign-in procedure when you went in. They had security guards around, and the fellow who had signed in ahead of me was A.O. Neer, a physics professor from Minnesota. There'd been a piece in the New York Times about Neer finding that you could split the atom with the release of energy. He sort of was almost up with what the Germans had done, and so this had been published in the New York Times, and I'd read it, and so I then decided I knew what we were working on, although we didn't know quite how we fit into the picture. It turned out, of course, that they'd counted on polytetrafluoroethylene to be the gasket material for the gaseous diffusion process, And it was to be used down at Oak Ridge in the gaseous separation, but it didn't turn out to be a really satisfactory gasket material. It would flow under pressure, and it also, there were enough impurities in the polymer the way we made it then that there were reactions with uranium hexafluoride, and there were a number of things that mitigated against that, but a lot of poly-TFE went into the war effort. A lot of it was used out at Hanford, actually, in the plutonium process. We found that's where P. Willard Crane soon went. He went out and took a job there and was there during the rest of the war years, and I had then moved into his position. I was head of an engineering group that was doing the scale-up of polymerization. Then I'd taken a night school course in Badger and McCabe and became an engineer. It's always been a source of embarrassment to my chemical engineering friends, but I got into the American Institute of Chemical Engineers as a senior member or something. They had a classification then, and I made that on the strength of my...
I think somewhere I recall you said that you were, at the time that Dunning wanted you to be making 1 million pounds a month, you were making it in 100-gram lots?
50 or 100 grams. We had a rocker tube, and we'd manufacture it that way, and so it
were
was...
Were you principally looking at catalysts, trying to find better catalysts?
Well, this was one of the things. Actually, I can't remember the exact schedule. I think I told you that one of my contributions individually, in a sense, was the development of an initiator that was used later on for the manufacture of most of the polytetrafluoroethylene that DuPont had. But at the time, we were using ammonium persulfate. We were getting a granular polymer, and it was quite a little while later. I don't know how many months, but that we got into this work on alternative catalysts to try and improve the properties of the product.
And how many people were there working with you on that?
Oh, we had a group of, I suppose, 10 or 12 young engineers working, plus some accessory help, and most of them were involved on Teflon. Actually, I spoke to you about the accident that we had, the tragedy. At that time, we were running a pilot plant. We'd scaled the thing up to so that we had maybe a 200-gallon reactor, and we're making batch polymerizations. We had to have the monomer would come from the Jackson laboratory with an inhibitor, and we would have to distill it to get the inhibitor, remove the inhibitor, and then carry out the polymerization. And it was we had a three-shift operation. We were trying to make material heat sintering process that we did at Arlington. We would make blocks, which they then could shave to produce tapes or produce gasket materials. And and as I probably have often said, and which most people know, the pilot plant stage is the stage where you're apt to run into accidents. And even at best, the hazards are there. You're doing new things and with scaled up quantities. And so we had the unfortunate experience that I think the first tragedy was that they involved the organic chemicals department, where workers were distilling who had been purifying monomer, took still residues and tried to vent them up a hood in the laboratory. And they were poisoned by material that leaked out of the hood, and so they, three of them died, and they...
What material would that have been?
Oh, they're fluorine-containing chemicals, yeah. I don't know what the composition, I don't suppose, was ever determined.
Right.
George Holbrook, I remember, came up to our place. We had a Podbielniak still at the time that we were purifying monomers with, and he brought up some of this material, and we were trying to identify what it was. George had been the supervisor of these people who were killed, and he was later a pillar in the society, George Holbrook was. And I remember his anguish, and later on I could share it. But
when you say that they died from inhalation, I mean, was it the fact that the hoods were incapable of venting it properly, or was it too much at one time?
I don't know. It, as I said, we didn't know as much about hoods then as we did now, and they apparently had run a tube over into the hood, and as I recall, they actually had most of the I can't recall that for sure, whether they had the sash down or not. But anyway, they were venting it, and it evidently was not all going up the stack, so it killed them.
Was there anyone else in the room with them at the time, or were they all?
I don't know. I wasn't down there, of course, so that was down at the Jackson Laboratory near Wilmington, across the bay from Wilmington. Okay.
What was the response of the company after that, that happened?
The company, I wasn't as deeply involved in that accident. When we had ours, I became impressed with the fact that the company regarded safety as an economic necessity, not just they weren't just paternalistic, there were economic factors involved, and they were not going to make the widows wealthy. Those who were left, there, of course, there were state laws as to what the compensation requirements were in industrial accidents, and I think the implication was that DuPont would not really exceed what they had to do, but in cases of hardship, they then would look after people. This was the impression that I had. Our accident was in the pilot plant stage, and we were both short-handed and were trying to do too much, and we had two men on the night shift. We had round-the-clock operations. There were bigger shifts daytime, but from 12 to 8, that particular shift involved only two men who had presumably lesser responsibilities, but could do things a lot. I had been in Wilmington all day, had gotten home late at 1:30 in the morning. I lived near enough the plant that I could walk to the plant. I heard an explosion. A little while later, the phone rang, and I was told that I should now see the wife of one of the boys that was injured. She lived upstairs in the apartment where we lived. She was pregnant. They had been teachers in a Sunday school class I was the superintendent of, and I had to sit with her and the wife of the other young man down in the hospital the night these kids died. Well, this turned out, it was just before Thanksgiving, and the parents of the boy that was killed, the one that I knew best, came from Kansas, and we had them, and we had to start rebuilding the plant. There was a question, was sabotage involved? It was one of the questions, of course. It was an important thing, and so I don't know how I survived, really, because we had to start the redesign and reconstruction of the plant immediately. And
what was the time frame? When did the first one occur down at Jackson Labs, and then when was the time of yours?
I don't know how I could reconstruct that. I don't think I have any.
Okay.
Any the one at Jackson Lab happened first, but I can't recall this exactly. But, we then, of course, developed a remote control system where everything was done behind barricades. Our safety precautions depended upon keeping things at low temperature, and the thing that had happened was that we had every now and then one of the cylinders in which we had refined monomer, which was being kept at low temperatures, even so one of them would start plugging up with polymer, the valve would, and so we had whenever this began to happen, we would take the cylinders, they'd chill them in dry ice and solvent and chill them down and take valve out, and it turned out ultimately that the two fellows who were killed on the night shift had decided that one of the cylinders that was empty, they would change the valve on, and they didn't get it done, so they left it for the next shift. The next shift was too busy, and they didn't get it done. The next shift didn't get too busy, so when these people came back on the 12th day, here was this cylinder sitting out that still had never had anything done to it. And when they were in course of taking the valve out, when the cylinder blew up, what had happened was they had misread the weight of the thing. According to the ultimate records, they missed it by 10 pounds. They thought it was empty, and they'd thrown it on the scale and misread the scale. Again, on a 12 to 8 shift, I suppose it's possible, and But it wasn't the kind of a thing you could defend very well as a safety expert, but it was a dreadful business.
How old were these people?
They were they were under 30, both of them. One of them was a college trained engineer, the other one was a technician.
What was the frequency of incidents like this happening at DuPont during
that? Oh, they were rare. Actually, we had plant. DuPont was really a pioneer in laboratory safety. I was interested. Jefferson, the retired president of the DuPont, gave a talk not long ago in which he attributed much of DuPont's economic success to the fact that they developed this safety program, which was a good program. We'd had all kinds of reasons to try and be safety conscious, and there would be contests in which plants would compete for the maximum number of man hours without an accident. This was posted outside the plants, and boy, if a fellow had an accident, he was an unpopular character. If he smashed his thumb or something and had to go to the hospital or something, he was going to be in Dutch with his friends. We've got nylon stockings. We had the first nylon stockings my wife ever had came as a safety prize during this period. The company offered these for all people working in the plant and laboratory. We were a laboratory in a plant, so we had this factory atmosphere in addition to having our research laboratory there.
In view of the fact that your accident at Arlington was essentially human error, did the company take care of the families in any respect?
Well, what I say was, I think to the best knowledge that I could see, they met the minimum requirements. But I think they had a life insurance policy, perhaps in addition to the minimum requirements. But we were told, sort of unofficially, that if these people, if the wives became really troubled financially, that the DuPont company would look after them. I don't know whether that ever happened or not.
Okay.
But there was, it certainly was not a case in which the families were compensated for the value of the life of the young people who were sacrificed. But
were you involved at all in any of the US-6 testing or other property testing of the polymer? Or were you involved primarily in just the manufacturing?
Well, we had to do some. We took most of these things over to the SAM laboratories and dealt with the people there. But we got some of the first fluorine gas that was being distributed in cylinders. One of the safety people in the Arlington plant nearly had apoplexy one day because he was walking by our had to. Number of little laboratories that were set up that they'd been originally, I think, nitration cells or something, had been rebuilt as small laboratories. This fellow came walking by one of them, and there was a copper tube sticking out the window, and he happened to look at it, and just then a 3-foot area of grass went up in smoke, and he came wild-eyed in to find out what the hell was going on in this laboratory. We were venting a cylinder that had contained fluorine, in which we'd been testing samples of polytetrafluoroethylene to see how it behaved with fluorine.
How long did your work then in Teflon continue? ACS paper and that IEC paper was after the war was over, is that correct?
Well, I stayed with it, until after the war. I was involved in development. After the war, as I say, I suppose that I can't really. The paper, I think, was given in 1946, as I recall. And I think maybe it was late 1945. What is the date on that? The paper appeared September of 46, and I think it was the spring of 46 where I gave that paper. I left DuPont in 1949, and I was associated I had been head of the so-called process development group, and then I became head of the product development group. And this, so I worked on the evaluations of polytetrafluoroethylene and various commercial applications. And well, and we had other products, of course, that were coming along, the polymethylmethacrylate, polyethylene, nylon moldings, and various experimental compositions.
What was the impetus behind giving this information at an ACS meeting?
Well, when DuPont, of course, was interested in marketing the product commercially, I think the price was considered ridiculous. I think it was $55 a pound at the time, but the it was an extraordinary product that was obviously going to have some unusual uses. And so that after the war was over and you could start developing markets for it, DuPont wanted commercial interest in it. And so that I've often left another extraordinary day of my life involved the day that I gave the paper. The DuPont advertising people, marketing people, got me out of bed that morning. And they had things. One of the men came up with something that I incorporated in the paper that I always thought was a real nice touch. He offered the statement that if anybody at this American Chemical Society meeting has come up with a universal solvent, we have the container for it. But anyway, I was involved in a number of things all morning. I didn't get any breakfast. I didn't get any lunch. I went to the gave the paper shortly after lunch. It was the first paper after lunch. We had a tremendous crowd. People stayed around afterwards asking me questions, and so I didn't get anything to eat. I went to the ACS News Service cocktail party, where Glenn Seaborg was really the lion of the hour, but the Teflon paper detracted quite a bit of interest. But I went to this darn place, and I was thirsty. I drank far too many Manhattans, and I was the worst one in Atlantic City. And I finally got to Charlie Parsons' farewell banquet, and I wanted to see my major professor, George Gloeckler. And I finally got there with a bunch of barflies, and George Gloeckler took one look at us and got up and left the meeting. It was a long time before I really was on good terms with him again. But
you said he was a very strict...
Gloeckler was more liberal, but a bottle of beer on a warm summer afternoon was his idea of drinking. He didn't... And really, I was in a disreputable condition. I don't know how I was navigating, but it was...
What kind of...
But I want to say one other thing. Strangely enough, although that Teflon paper attracted a great deal of interest, the next paper which was given was probably of much more scientific importance. Cal Schilnick gave a paper in which he first talked... Do you know Cal Schilnick?
He
gave a paper in which he first was discussing a possibility that you might have isomers formed in polymerization. In a way, this preceded Vanatta and the people who got Nobel Prizes, but Cal didn't have it tied down, but all he had was these suspicions. He was, depending on how he polymerized isobutylene, he was getting, I think it was isobutylene, he was getting these differences in properties. And so he suspected that there must be isomeric differences that were involved. And I think we all, I was listening to it with one ear while people were kind of asking me questions. I thought poor Cal's flipped his lid, you know, this is an impossibility. And so that, nobody was really paying much attention to him. And it must have been a discouraging thing for him, because here he had probably one of the important papers at the meeting, and it was kind of ignored.
He
had left DuPont. He'd been a worker at the DuPont laboratory earlier, and had left and had gone to General Anlin.
Did he get many questions afterwards, or was it just skepticism?
I don't think too much. They were just kind of skepticism. I don't recall he got many questions at all. He later wrote good books on polymerization. Now, he was a German that was really a rigid character, and he was... Cal's made... many enemies along the way, but he had an important contribution there. He became head of chemistry later on at Gettysburg, and he ran a tight ship there. I don't know whether you had contact with
where
him.
Where I know the name from is from Gettysburg. Was there a link then between your announcing to the world the DuPont, the Teflon properties that you had studied and sales and...
Oh, yes, it was really basically a sales thing. Actually, Bob Joyce and Butch Hanford and somebody else prepared a paper for Journal of Chemical Education, which was more of a scientific paper, in a sense. And but I was given the job of giving a paper at American Chemical Society meeting, which was the first paper really given outside. And then I think later on when the publications came out, it's my recollection that Hanford, Joyce, and I can't think who the other one was, that came out a month ahead of our industrial engineering chemistry paper. But
now, you you left DuPont in 49. You had mentioned earlier there were three major items that you had, and I'm not sure if the other two took place after DuPont or while you were...
Well, one of them at DuPont. The photopolymerization thing took part at DuPont. That had involved an effort. We were trying to make very large castings of methylmethacrylate, which would be used in Schmidt lenses that the Air Force presumably needed for photographing... for inspections as airplanes were flying over battle areas. And so these had to be optically perfect, and and it was very difficult to get such large casting. If you tried to make them out of molding materials, there was enough adsorption on the surface of granules that that these introduced aberrations, and so you had to have them really castings. Well, when you were trying to cast anything this big, heat would be generated in the middle of the casting, and you'd start getting bubbles, and that'd be a problem. So I decided we'd do some photopolymerization studies, try and see if we could handle the thing on perhaps a longer-term basis without having so much heat dissipating in the problem in the middle. And so there had been discoveries at the experimental station that acylones were good, were photocatalysts, and I read their patents. We tried acylones, and it didn't solve the problem, particularly since there tended to be a yellow color with the acylones that we could get. And so I started synthesizing some ethers of acylones to see if somehow these would improve on what acylones were able to do. And I got the acylone, the methyl ether of a non-aromatic acylone, and this was a tremendous photopolymerization catalyst. It really was extraordinary. It didn't solve the problem on which I was working, but we patented it, and we weren't able to do anything else with it really, although I think I included it in a patent application we had on polymerizable dental fillings. I had a dental filling put in which we used that as in the filling material, but to activate the catalyst. But as a personal triumph, this isn't strictly a digression, but we didn't do anything more as the station started picking it up, but we had an assistant director of research named Robert Burke, who was kind of a bull in a china shop. He'd come from Western Reserve University to DuPont and was a very bright man. He'd been a Rhodes Scholar